Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and this is Beta. Jennifer Egan took a lot of creative risks when she wrote her novel, A Visit from the Goon Squad. The risks paid off. Goon Squad won the Pulitzer Prize for fiction. Now Jennifer's published her follow-up novel. It's called Manhattan Beach, and it couldn't be more different from Goon Squad. Manhattan Beach is set during World War II and introduces us to Anna Kerrigan, the Brooklyn Navy Yard's only female diver. Anna is haunted by the disappearance of her father. So why is this novel so different from Jennifer's previous book?
Well, I'm just trying to keep myself interested, I guess. Once I've been living with a book for a while, I'm just ready for a change. It's kind of like, you know, travel. When you've been somewhere a long time, you're ready to go somewhere else.
I almost found it hard to believe that Manhattan Beach was written by the same author as A Visit from the Goon Squad, because as I was reading Manhattan Beach, I was getting kind of a Charles Dickens vibe from it and a bit of Raymond Chandler. Does that make sense to you?
For sure. I mean, I love 19th century fiction. Interestingly, I kind of approached the two books the same way. You know, they both are complex stories. I think Goon Squad calls attention to its complexity a little more because it's structured sort of like a concept album.
Yeah, exactly.
But in both, I sort of mix genres. I was thinking about serialized television and about Marcel Proust as I worked on A Visit from the Goon Squad. And with Manhattan Beach, you're quite right to mention Chandler. I was thinking very much about the noir, which is such an urban form.
Mm-hmm.
But then also, there's very much a sort of a sea story in this book. So in a way, I kind of fused those two genres, the noir with a story of sea survival. And it's funny because I thought, can I really do that? Those two genres just have nothing in common. But I realized that, in fact, they're very similar. In both of them, you have a sort of warm pocket of humanity surrounded by an existential threat.
Mm.
In the case of a sea story, it's obviously the ocean. And so survival is always a question in a story like that. And in the noir, it's the urban, the sort of ominous, urban, shadowy mystery that surrounds whatever's going on in the noir. So, in fact, the two genres made more sense together than I had expected.
Mm, that's interesting. Yeah, I didn't think of that, but hearing you say that, yeah, that makes perfect sense. And, of course, that would also explains why the epigraph for Manhattan Beach comes from Herman Melville's Moby Dick, probably the ultimate sea story. And do you remember the epigraph by heart?
Yes, as everyone knows, meditation and water are wedded forever.
That's a great quote. Why did you choose that particular quote as the epigraph?
Well, for one thing, Melville is actually talking about the New York waterfront when he says that. He opens Moby Dick with a kind of rumination on why it is that people always want to go to the shore. And he's talking about Lower Manhattan, the Battery. So it just felt quite perfect for this book, which in a certain way I was led through from one world to another by the water, starting with the New York waterfront, the Port of New York, which mm-hmm. was a very important place during World War II. The Brooklyn Navy Yard was the largest builder and repairer of Allied ships in the world.
Wow.
That led me to deep sea diving, which was a feature of ship repair. And also, you know, a lot of salvage work that was done during the war. The world of crime, which was, you know, rampant on the waterfront, immortalized by the movie On the Waterfront, which
right,
is actually
yeah.
derived from a series of newspaper exposés of the New York waterfront and the corrupt unions there. So the water really was, if music kind of led me through A Visit from the Goon Squad from one world to another, the water led me through Manhattan Beach from one world to another. And just one more funny thing, you know, you mentioned the differences between those two books, which really are stark. In A Visit from the Goon Squad, there are a lot of structural extremes. I've got a chapter in PowerPoint.
Yeah.
I've got a chapter in the form of a celebrity profile. I think with Manhattan Beach, the extremes are happening in the action itself. There's a lot of big scenes, big dramatic scenes of the kind that are very hard to write in the fragmentary style I used in Goon Squad. That's
mm-hmm.
better suited to action that's happening off stage. But here, more in the manner of an old-fashioned adventure story, we've got a shipwreck, we've got survival at sea, we've got murders. I felt like to write those big, rich scenes, I just needed to let it rip in a more
yeah.
traditional way.
Huh. Yeah, that's great. Yeah. Now would be a great time to have you read an excerpt from Manhattan Beach. And if you could set it up, that would be great.
Sure. I mean, I'll start by just saying there are a number of worlds that this book includes. And I write a lot about people at work at the Brooklyn Navy Yard, with shipbuilding, deep sea diving, merchant sailing, and even sort of criminal activity. Anna is determined to become a diver, and there were many civilian divers at the Brooklyn Navy Yard. It takes her a long time to get herself into the water. There are many obstacles against her. So Anna is wearing a 200-pound diving suit known as the Mark V. It is excruciating to wear on land because all of those 200 pounds are bearing down on you. But she has it on, and she's now descending into the water for the first time. Holding the curled rails of the diving ladder, she began taking careful backward steps, finding each rung with the metal tip of her shoe before resting her weight there. Water contracted around her legs with cold energy, suctioning the wrinkles in her jumpsuit pinchingly to her skin. Ice cakes nudged at the dress. Soon the water was at her chest, then lapping the bottom of the faceplate. Anna took a last look up and saw Bascom and Marl watching her from the ladder. Two more rungs and she was submerged, the green-brown water of Wallabout Bay visible through her four windows, no sound but the hiss of air. On the last of the ladder's 14 rungs, she paused to increase her air supply. Sure enough, the dress inflated slightly, easing the water's pressure on her legs. She felt for the descending line, swung her left leg around its manila cord, and let it slide through her left glove as she drifted down, the weight of the dress lulling her toward the bottom, the water darkening as she left the surface behind. At last, her shoes met the bottom of Wallabout Bay. Anna couldn't see it, just the wisps of her legs disappearing into dark. She felt a rush of well-being whose source was not instantly clear. Then she realized the pain of the dress had vanished. The air pressure from within it was just enough to balance the pressure from outside while maintaining negative buoyancy, i.e. holding her down. And the weight that had been so punishing on land now allowed her to stand and walk under 30 feet of water that otherwise would have spat her out like a seed.
That was great. Thank you so much. So didn't you also talk to the first female U.S. Army deep sea diver?
Yes. Her name is Andrea Motley Crabtree. Even though she did not dive, well, first of all, no women dove for the Navy until the 70s. Mm-hmm. She was the first for the Army, and she didn't dive until the 80s.
Oh, wow.
But even she wore the old Mark V because they would still use it as a way of training people. And she was enormously helpful. She was really good at talking about the sensations of being in the water and especially of being near enormous ships, mm-hmm. What that felt like, how they sort of vibrated or almost seemed to hum. And then she also talked about the sexism that she encountered in diving, which was profound and ultimately ended her career, although she's far from bitter and remembers diving with great joy and great vividness. It's a tough world for a woman.
Yeah, and that sexism in diving, that is explored in your novel, yeah. I'm guessing that your research did not include listening to XTC's 1980 album, Black Sea, over and over. You know, the album cover there with the band members decked out in vintage diving gears, or did it?
You know, I'm already sad about missing that because that would have been a point of connection to a visit from the Goon Squad.
Yeah, it would have been, yeah, since that was so musically based. Yeah, and rock and roll, great rock and roll pauses. Yeah, so you did so much research, and I've read that you did tons of research for this book. You can tell just by reading the book. And in the acknowledgments, you write that if nothing more came of the endeavor than the pleasure of having researched it, I would count myself lucky. And I get that joy of research from you, from what you just said, how much you enjoy doing it. But reading between the lines of that note in the acknowledgments, it sounds like this was a very hard book for you to write. Would that be fair to say?
It was definitely the hardest book I've written. I think what made it so hard was not the research per se, but since the thing that's so special about fiction is it's the one art form that really lets you go inside the deep thoughts, the intimate inner life of another person, I found it impossible to portray those inner lives without knowing all of that background, without knowing what people are remembering, what they know without even knowing they know it. And that took a lot longer to acquire than I thought. And until I acquired that kind of fluency, let's say, what I felt was that I just couldn't do my thing as a writer in this world. It wasn't being funny. It felt very stiff. There were no extremes. And that's all the stuff I love. So it was kind of the equivalent of trying to interact with someone in a language you don't know very well and finding that you're a very unnuanced person in that language. You don't get jokes. You can't make jokes. In a certain way, you're effectively not capable of complex thought.
Yeah.
That's sort of how I was the writerly version of that stiff, limited person for a long time. And I was pretty clear that if I couldn't get better than that, this book was not going to be published. I was not in no way was I going to publish a book I didn't feel really was, you know, me as a writer moving around in the way I like to.
Yeah, and that makes total sense, what you just said, also because fiction is all about the details. And you have to immerse yourself into all that and get the references and the culture and figure that out before you can create those details. I want to ask you about your creative process. I recently watched this interview with Lauren Groff in which she talked about writing 10 or 12 drafts in longhand, and I know you write in longhand, and Lauren says she does these first drafts very quickly to get a sense of the landscape, and this gives her a handhold into this story. Is that kind of similar to the way you work?
Yes, very much so. It's interesting. I didn't know she did that. I love her work. I write a first draft continuously without looking back of whatever I'm doing. So for this book, that meant 1,400 handwritten pages over the course of a year and a half.
Wow.
The reason I do it that way is I'm looking to get out ahead of my conscious thoughts. I find that what I can think of in terms of a plot is never very interesting. I'm looking for the things I can't think of. I want to be surprised.
Yeah.
A good analogy would probably be something like improvisational theater. You know, you throw people together on a stage, what happens? That's kind of what I'm doing with myself. I'm looking to make myself improvise. And often I don't really remember what the beginning of the book is like by the time I finish it. Then I type it up and I read it. And that is a very painful moment because now I'm subjecting this outpouring, this really a big mess is what it is. I'm looking at that, in a typeface, and it's agony. But what I also am hopefully finding is that I have a sense of what it feels like it could be, and I'm starting to get ideas of how to push it one step closer to that. So I make my first outline once I have a first draft, and then I'm very analytical about what I think it could be, what needs to happen to move it one step closer, and I have, you know, bullet points and checklists, and I go back in and I start editing, usually by hand on hard copies. And I implement my instructions. So I do find that at the end of the day, it's usually between 30 and 50 drafts per chapter. But that sounds a little more extreme than I think it really is, because if you think about editing on a computer screen, all the times you'll go over a sentence, that adds up. It's just that the difference in my method is I know how many times I've done it.
Yeah, exactly. And even once you've written the outline, I imagine with further revisions that the story can undergo further changes, right? There can be more.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I do a new outline for each revision, each big revision. And hopefully the outline gets shorter. So, in the end, hopefully my outline is, a page or two down from 50 to 70.
Yeah. If you could live in any fictional universe, which one would you choose? It could be one of your own, or it could be someone else's.
Well, one thing about me is that I rarely want to return to a fictional world that I've explored before. If I've finished the book and I've really done it right, that world should feel somewhat exhausted for me.
Yeah.
I miss being in New York in the kind of noirish version of New York that I was writing about in Manhattan Beach. I feel kind of longing for it even while I'm in New York. I'll sort of look around at old buildings and think, I just want to be back with Dexter Stiles at his nightclub. And I think what that really is a measure of is how once I got through that feeling of stiffness and lack of fluency, when I finally crossed over and began to enjoy myself, it was a thrill unlike any I've experienced as a writer. It really did feel like time travel. Mm. And I really want more of that, I have to say. So I went from thinking, never again will I write a historical novel, to thinking, 19th century maybe?
Yeah. So do you have any idea? Can you tell us what's next? It's probably not, it's not going to be noir. It's not going to be sea stories. It's not going to be the Gothic, because you've already been there, done that.
Well, here's what I hope. I mean, you know, this, because an idea for me is so vague, it just really means a time and place I want to explore and may or may not pan out. But my hope is to actually write a companion to A Visit from the Goon Squad for my next book.
Oh, cool.
It never felt really finished. I mean, there were people I wanted to write about that I couldn't write about successfully. That the PowerPoint was a last minute add on. It always felt open ended to me, and there were always people I was curious about that I hadn't found a way to follow into their worlds yet. So that's my hope.
Excellent.
We'll see how it turns out.
Jennifer Egan is the author of Manhattan Beach. Find out more at wpr.org/beta.